Good evening, welcome all, and welcome to this British Government at LSE event on immigration and asylum in Britain and Europe. The hashtag, as I've just shouted all over the room and couldn't see it, whereas all you could, is up there and indeed up here, so it's easy to see. This is the second event. Many of you may have been here for the first one. We had one which was looking predominantly at attitudes within Britain. We will be looking at that again today, actually. But last time, concentrating particularly on how public policy and the need to provide public services had influenced the debate within the UK. Today, we're going to draw the focus out a little bit to look at the way in which the debate across Europe and by what's been going on in Europe, which is a very wide range of things in recent months, will have or is likely to have affected opinion in Britain about this extraordinarily complex and endlessly intriguing issue. I'll say no more than that. We have three distinguished speakers today. And I'll read a very brief biography of each of them now, and then we'll move straight on. We're going to hear from Sarah first, and then Deborah, and then Eiko. Eiko Thielman here is Associate Professor in European Politics and Policy at the LSE, and also Director of the Migration Studies Unit here also at LSE. And his research interests include the European Union, immigration, international cooperation, including burden sharing and migration. Sarah Hobolt is Sutherland Chair in European Institutions at the school. Her research interests include European Union politics, political behaviour, particularly elections and referendums, public opinion and comparative European politics, and she's currently working on a Leverhulme Trust-funded project on the public constraint on European integration. And then our friend Deborah Mattinson is a founding director of Britain Thinks and a regular supporter of events at the LSE. I've sat in this room, not one of our events, but within very recently, just before the election, on another occasion with Deborah. Britain Thinks is an enterprise dedicated to understanding, well, I wrote very well, what Britain thinks, really. It's the name is in the title. She was also a pollster to Gordon Brown, firstly as Chancellor of the Exchequer and then as Prime Minister. And Deborah frequently writes and broadcasts about the mood of the nation, and in 2010 she published a book called Talking to a Brick Wall, the story of the new Labour years through the eyes of the voter. I was smiling just at the excellently chosen title there. Anyway, we're going to hear from each of our speakers for about 5, 6, 7, 8 minutes. It's a bit longer than that, actually, by the time it happens. And then we'll have plenty of time for Q&A and discussion afterwards. So, Sarah, perhaps I can ask you to kick off.
Thank you so much, Tony. And I'll show some slides, which is why I'm going over here. So when Tony asked me to do this, speak at this event, obviously I knew that, you know, immigration is a salient topic. It's always a salient topic in Europe. It's one of the key topics in elections, one of the key topics concerned for voters. But I didn't know quite how salient and important it would be today. What I'll say a bit about is the rising salience in general. Of course, we have events like the Paris attacks that makes it even more salient. But in general, it's something that the public is ever more concerned about, and political parties are mobilizing to increasing degrees across Europe. I'll look specifically at UK attitudes and then say, what does the literature, what does social science have to tell us about why there's an increasing public opposition to immigration? And then finally, just show you a few figures about how British attitudes compare to the rest of Europe. What we know about the British press, of course, this is a, you know, a selection of sort of the more tabloid end, but the fact that immigration and refugees is a highly salient issue, something we see in the front pages all the time. Generally, it's portrayed as a problem. There was a short week here when we had a lot of dead children in the news where there was a more humanitarian angle on it that, you know, we ought to do something. This is a problem we have to solve. But generally, it's a problem that's caused by the EU, where we have to stand up to the rest of Europe. And this very close connection between Europe and immigration is a key issue and a greater issue in the British debate on migration than we see in the rest of Europe. But this kind of headlines are not unrepresentative of the British tabloid press. It also is reflected in public opinion when you ask people what is the most important issue. Immigration have been an important issue for decades in Britain and in Europe. It's not new, but we do see an increase in recent years, not least with the migration crisis in Europe. And now it's generally features as the most important issue and the most important problem if you ask people about that. Now, of course, it's not entirely new if we go back and look at public opinion data, and here are data where you ask, are there too many immigrants? And this is the percentage saying there are too many immigrants. Back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, people also thought there were too many immigrants. So not to say that the British have all of a sudden become, you know, more prejudiced or bigoted and not liking immigrants where they used to think, love it. No, that's not a new thing. But what is a new thing to an extent is the salience of it. This is a quite representative question. I could have shown you many different polls about preferred levels of immigration. Yeah, so a majority would like to reduce it a lot or a little, and there are very few people thinking it should be increased a lot or a little, or indeed even remain the same. One thing where, if you look at it in a cross-national perspective and compare with other EU countries, where Britons are a bit different than others is they don't really distinguish much between EU workers and non-EU workers when it comes to whether or not the costs of having immigrants, that's the red bars, outweigh the benefits. So generally, both for EU workers and non-EU workers, the costs are seen to outweigh the benefit. Although if we add up here the pink and the green column, they do add up to about 20% who think either the benefits outweigh the cost or it's about equal. So it's not to say that everyone thinks it's necessarily so. But just to give you this illustration that it's really not something that's specific to workers coming from outside the European Union, where if you look in the rest of Europe, generally people are more positive towards immigrants coming from inside the EU than outside. Now, one thing we might think is, well, it has to do with this term immigrants. If you ask about refugees, you know, people fleeing terror and persecution, surely people have a very different attitude. But this is not really the case. This was a survey experiment conducted in September, so after we saw these pictures of dead Syrian children on the beaches. And here they had different question wording, the percentage of people saying we should accept more or fewer people when described in the following ways: fleeing terror or persecution, refugees, immigrants, or migrants. And we do see, as we'd expect, that they want to accept fewer when it's migrants, immigrants, and refugees, but the differences are really quite small. So even with refugees, there is 49% saying we should accept fewer. Now, I just want to say a word about that in relation to the EU referendum, because it's clearly going to be a huge issue and topic to do with how people are going to vote and the debate on the forthcoming EU referendum. A key argument from the Leave side is going to have to do with that this argument that if we leave, we can control our borders better and we're going to be able to reduce the amount of immigration, in particular from within the EU. And here again, there was a question conducted by YouGov in August where they asked, is this a convincing argument, this that the government will radically be able to reduce the amount of immigration? And what we see from people whose vote intention is to remain, it's about equally split between people who find it convincing, unconvincing. For people who say that they want to leave the EU, 86% say this is a convincing argument. And for the undecideds, interestingly, very few people think it's unconvincing, but about 44% thinks it's a convincing argument. Now, that's just to say that this is going to be part, you know, I'm not going to say causation, but it's clearly part of the debate, both shaping attitudes towards the EU, but also shaping attitudes towards these kind of arguments. And it's going to be crucial part of the campaign about whether or not to stay in or leave. You know, what will be the implications for immigration policy? Just a few words about what we know shapes attitudes towards immigration, not just in Britain, but generally. Socioeconomic status matters if we look at the individual level, so economic vulnerability, low-skilled, low-educated people are more likely to be opposed to immigration and refugees. But it's not as simple as that. For example, it's not necessarily that you're more opposed to people of your own occupational group just because you feel threatened. In fact, cultural values are often far more important, ethnocentrism and opposition to multiculturalism in general. Also, people are also mobilized by party queues, and across Europe, of course, particularly parties on the far right and radical right are mobilizing the issue around immigration. And one thing that's interesting is there's very mixed evidence about whether or not proximity to immigrants in your local community, so living in a very diverse community, whether or not that matters. Some research shows it makes you more tolerant, others less, and it's really not something we have a good answer to. At the contextual level, certainly there's no evidence that being in a country where you have higher levels of integration or higher inflows of integration makes you more or less tolerant. You can live in a country with very low levels of immigration, or indeed in a context which is entirely homogeneous with no immigrants and be opposed to it. A lot of this has to do with perceptions and radicalization and politicization of the issue. And if we go to perception, and again, it's not that the Brits are particularly that they have, there's a mismatch between perceptions and reality. It's really across Europe. This was The Economist brought this week, and I thought it was interesting. It is the percentage of the public's answer to how many Muslims do you think there is in the population and the actual answer. So British people think that it's 21% of the population who's Muslim against the actual 5%. In Germany, it's 19% against the actual 6%. In France, where they have a high Muslim population of 8%, but they think they're 31%. And so it's not to say that British are particularly, but it's really across Europe. And it's really these perceptions that drive attitudes much more than any reality. Now, does that mean that the Brits are somehow in the more anti-immigration, anti-refugee end of things? No, not if we ask. If we look at very recent Eurobarometer data from last week and we look at whether or not the economy needs legal migrants from outside the EU, we see that the Brits are amongst the most positive, 70% thinking, yes, the British economy needs migrants from outside the EU. What about from inside the EU? It goes slightly down, but again, we can see they are very much in the positive end. In the negative end, it's Central and Eastern Europe countries that generally have not been receivers of migrants, but they certainly don't think their economy needs any more. And in terms of culture, do migrants contribute to cultural life? Again, we see the Brits being here, 76% saying yes. So it's not, in a comparative European perspective, it's not that the Brits are any more resistant to migrants than the rest of Europe, but certainly the issue of opposition to and fear of the cultural and economic threat of migrants is a Europe-wide phenomenon. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Then just before I move on to Deborah, so what you're saying then there is that they...
Sorry everybody. That even though people see economic and cultural reasons to be broadly open to migration in Britain, they're nevertheless, they just want less of it. Is that to some extent what they're saying there? Have I misread that, misheard that?
Well, people generally want fewer immigrants.
They want fewer, but they are quite sympathetic to some of the underlying benefits, or they can be in favour of, they see there's a benefit to the economy from migration, but they just don't want any migrants, if you see what I mean. Is that right?
The survey questions are slightly different. So okay. The Eurobarometer survey questions are partly designed to get quite positive responses. So if you look at the aggregates, I think what we can use those survey responses to get at, that if you ask them like that, the Brits are not any more anti-immigration than the other Europeans. In fact, on the positive end.
Okay, right. Deborah, I think you were actually in Paris at the weekend.
I was,
right?
Yes. Yes, I was. It was very strange being there. Horrible. Anyway, what I'm going to do... Actually, you literally covered some of the things I was going to cover. So I'm going to try and sort of quickly reshift my contribution and draw more on qualitative, which I think is a little, you know, more diagnostic information. But I won't be able to resist, I think, quoting some of the things. I think the first thing to say is that we talk about this issue a lot right now and talk about it as if it's a relatively new issue. And obviously Sarah has just shown that concern about immigration has been, you know, around for a long time, since the 60s and before. But one thing that I have observed over the years that I've been, listening to people's views on a whole range of different things, is that it's only relatively recently that people have felt that they could talk about it and talk about their concerns. And I think that that is a real difference. And actually part of the problem that people feel with immigration, I think, is in part explained by that. And it's interesting, because you had a slide up, Sarah, and you said people not liking, you know, it's not just the Brits that don't like immigrants, it's not just that they're prejudiced and bigoted, as if not liking immigrants instantly meant you were prejudiced and bigoted. And that is exactly the kind of thing that a lot of voters that I listen to feel very worried about, and it makes them very angry indeed. And, you know, I basically, as I was kind of tracking public opinion through, particularly through the Labour government, as Tony said, I was working with a number of Labour politicians at the time. It was something that, it was like a sort of elephant in the room in so many focus groups, where people would talk about whatever their concerns were, and they'd kind of talk around the issue. And then what would happen in the focus group was that somebody, one person, would say, well, you know, I'm not being funny or anything, and I hope nobody thinks that I'm bigoted or prejudiced or any of the other, but I just want to say that actually I've got this concern about immigration, and I'm worried about it for these reasons. And then it would be like suddenly the doors were opened, and then once one person had seen the elephant in the room, they could all see it, you know, and everybody would talk about it, and then it would be very hard to get people to talk about anything else. And the frustration that they had was that they felt that no politicians were hearing this, and that they were the only people talking about it, and they were, you know, once they finally sort of bared their soul, that nobody was listening. I mean, actually, I think what voters think now is slightly different. I think they think that everybody's talking about it and nobody's actually doing anything. But I'll come back to that in a little while. Certainly what we've seen is it's not just an important issue of concern. It is the top issue of concern. And it has been, actually, for the last 5-6 years. It was briefly eclipsed by the economy during the financial crisis. But, you know, essentially it's been the number one issue of concern for quite a while. And one of the things that we learn from the focus groups is that I describe it as a vortex issue. It kind of sucks everything else in. So people use it as their explanation for kind of everything that is wrong in their world, basically. Who is concerned? Sarah's touched on this, so I won't really say anything more, other than to say that we've done quite a lot of work at Britain Thinks with an organisation called British Future, and if you're interested in this topic, they have a lot of useful data sources on their website, including some of the work we've done for them. One of the things that we did was an attempt to quantify people as people who were immigrant-friendly or immigrant-unfriendly, and basically the group that could broadly be described as immigrant-friendly were only 15% of the population. And even they, in fact, had some fairly major concerns with immigration, but they were just people who, on balance, to answer your question, Tony, on balance felt that the positives outweighed the negatives, 15%. And yeah, I mean, Sarah's already talked about who the people are that are most worried. They are older, they are working class. You're quite right, there isn't actually anything very clear about where people live. There's a bit of an urban myth that people who live in places least affected by immigration are the people most worried about. It's not actually true. But I think it is true to say that people that don't live in urban environments, like London, you know, big urban environments, are probably more worried by immigration. So what specifically are they concerned about? And this, I mean, you know, you posed a question, Tony, about, well, is there a bit of a kind of paradox here where people can see the contribution that's made to the economy? And I don't think it is a paradox, because I think people can see the contribution that's made to the economy, but they see it as a contribution that's made to big business. And they're kind of right there, actually. You know, they don't actually, for a lot of people, the benefits that are, you know, the rewards of immigration are not reaped by them. Having said that, I think that their biggest concerns are not economic. The biggest concerns that people have are actually, they're not about jobs, they're about public services. The feeling of the pressure that immigration places on public services, and then people will use a lot of anecdotal evidence. I went to A&E and, you know, there was nobody there that could speak English, or, you know, my daughter's struggling at school because in the class most of the kids can't speak English. So that's a very, very, you know, it's a massive issue. There's also a general feeling about a kind of diminution of British culture, whatever that might be. It's also, by the way, one of the positives of immigration is, the impact on British culture, and a kind of more vibrant culture, which people then, when you press them on that, usually what they talk about is food. That's often the only thing they talk about. But, you know, there's definitely a sense that British cuisine, God knows it needed it, has been lifted a little bit by the contribution of some people who've arrived here more recently. But, the downsides are also this. There is this sense, and this is particularly, I think, felt by older working class people, that whatever they think Britishness is has been diluted by immigration. There's a fear around that. There's also, Sarah talked about this, the EU is sort of one of the big issues, and I think this is one of the reasons why this is not going to go away anytime soon, because clearly, you know, there's going to be a referendum in the next 18 months. And this is what, you know, if you ask people what their concerns are about being in the EU, that is the concern, the number one concern by quite a long way. And that, you know, that's why if David Cameron were able to, you know, achieve something in his renegotiation, that's top of their list. Do they think he will achieve it? Well, no, 6 out of 10 don't think that he'll achieve it. So it remains to be seen, I think, what impact that has. What else? One thing that people ask me about quite a lot is, you know, well, has this changed now with the kind of Syrian refugees in particular? And there was a poll that was done almost immediately after that photograph that suggested that people that had seen that photograph, the photograph of the little boy, were 20% more likely to think that Britain should be more welcoming and should welcome more refugees. But generally, actually, the only impact I think that this has had is to shove it even further, the problem, the issue, further up the agenda, and not make people feel more sympathetic. And again, I think that what I'm getting a lot in focus groups is a sense that people are choosing their words carefully again. They don't want to look as if they are being horrible, but it actually hasn't altered the way that they feel. And a more recent poll than the one with the 20% who'd seen the photograph suggested that actually only 1 in 5 think that Britain should take in 20,000 refugees, which was what David Cameron committed to, and actually the rest all say fewer. So nothing much has changed, I think, other than immigration going up as a concern. Post-Paris, there is already a poll, post-Paris, that says, and inevitably this was going to happen, that post-Paris, 20% are less disposed to allow refugees, although 50% say, I haven't changed my mind, but then I always thought we should have fewer anyway. So that's where we are. Very briefly, and just to end, Tony asked me to say a little bit about, you know, what politicians' response might be. I think it's also an interesting thing about what the immigration industry, if you like, what the charities and think tanks and so on who are promoting the cause should say. We ran for British Future a very interesting workshop where we ran a focus group with ordinary members of the public, and we ran a focus group with people, senior people from those sorts of organisations. And then we put the two together, and we ultimately got them to kind of co-create some messages that would improve people's views of immigration. And it was incredibly interesting, the arguments that people had and the different starting points from both groups of people. And I mean, as a kind of rule of thumb, I'd say the immigration industry, I'm calling it that, I don't know what it would call itself, but you know what I mean, basically favoured values-led messages And very often they were quite negative about the people that were not welcoming, and you know, words like prejudice and bigoted and so on, and actually were about the values. The citizens themselves saw it as a much more transactional thing. If they wanted to be made to feel positive about immigration, they wanted very clearly to have the benefits spelt out to them. Now, there's an issue there, because I think then often the industry's response and its politicians' response as well is to spew out a load of stats, you know, and there's that kind of, if only everybody knew the stat that I know, then they'd all see the world from my point of view and they'd agree with me. But unfortunately, it doesn't seem to work like that. And again, actually with British Future, we've done quite a lot of message testing work, looking at what messages work and what messages don't work. And the problem is that if you don't start your message with where people are, even if you might not like that, then they're just not hearing the messages at all. They just screen it out. So, you know, I think the politicians and the industry alike, I say, resist stats. But beyond that, I think language does matter. It's interesting, actually, because you and I'd also pulled out the YouGov data about, you know, people fleeing, refugees, immigrants, migrants. I'd taken a rather different take on that. You quite rightly say there aren't very big differences. But I thought there were some differences. I thought, you know, I thought it did matter whether, you know, talking about people fleeing terror and persecution clearly gets stronger support than talking about migrants. So I think it does matter a bit, but I mean, it's not going to completely change people's views. But I suppose in terms of where politicians are, I think that it's going to be an incredibly interesting 12 months, 18 months, how long we've got up to the referendum. I think that we'll see the next election decided at that point too, because I think that this issue is going to be absolutely critical. Thanks.
Just before we move on to IQ, do you think that one of the difficulties that, given that politicians, for all their faults, are the people with the legitimacy, more than any, I mean, there are others in society, but particularly to lead a debate about how the public should understand issues, that their own collective, I wouldn't say fall from grace, I mean, politicians were never very popular, but I mean, the fact is that they've lost, in some ways, lost their own confidence to project messages, all of them, of all parties, with one or two exceptions in some of the edge parties. Is that fair? Do you think it's more difficult for politicians or any leaders these days to lead a debate about, even if you start from people's own views?
I think the problem that people have with politicians, as I said, there was this sense at one point, you know, talking 10 years ago more, where people felt that they were very concerned about this issue and politicians simply weren't hearing their concerns and it wasn't being talked about, and that it was not politically correct to talk about it, and they felt quite angry about that. What they do now feel is that politicians are doing a lot of the kind of, I hear what you, you know, I understand your problem. I mean, that was Ed Miliband's sort of, that was his mantra, that, you know, kind of, he talked about immigration quite a lot in the sense of saying, I know people are very worried about immigration, but didn't actually sort of have an answer and didn't have anything very much to say. I think what people feel is that they want their politicians to have an answer. Problem is, the 6 out of 10 people not trusting Cameron on the renegotiation, they don't actually necessarily think it will make a difference. One further thing, actually, just one point to that. On Europe, if, as I think we may vote to leave, if we do, then suddenly politicians don't have Europe to hide behind anymore. Mm-hmm. And this whole issue will, you know, really come into its own in a very different way.
Thank you, if you see what I mean. That's a bleak end.
Thank you very much. Sorry. That's what I thought. I couldn't get any better.
Thank you. Thank you, Tony. As Tony said, I run the LSE Migration Studies Unit here. We do quite a lot of research on refugee policy, both at the national as well as the European level. And that's really what I want to focus on. I want to focus a little bit more on policy rather than on public perception. And we'll mainly talk about refugee issues, although I guess my my starting point really is that in the British debate, as Sarah said, of course, the issues of intra-EU migration, free movement, economic migrants from outside the European Union, whether they're legal or irregular, and asylum seekers and refugees, they all get bunched up into one set of immigration issues. And, of course, the government has done its utmost to help us in that impression by setting a migration target that basically includes all of these categories in one go. I'll come back to that a bit later on. The reason why it is important to keep these different groups of migrants separate is, of course, that we're really talking about very different legal statuses, different legal obligations that states have with regard to these different migrant groups. And so I think it is doing the debate a great disservice if we're not careful in making those appropriate distinctions. Of course, over the last few months, we've here in the UK talked a lot about intra-EU migration, whether or not migrants from Eastern Europe have brought benefits or not to this country. Obviously, many people in continental Europe see it as political shadow boxing by Cameron, when the rest of the continent is really much more concerned about the greatest humanitarian crisis since the Second World War in terms of asylum and refugee inflows. Just to give you a historical comparison of figures, during the Second World War, there are estimates that about 50 million people in Europe were displaced. The UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, estimates that at the moment there are about 60 million people worldwide that are displaced. So what I want to do is, I guess, really put the discussion a bit in the context of national responses around Europe to immigration, how they've differed to the British response. I'll talk a little bit about the role of the EU and what the EU has tried to do in policy terms to address some of these issues. And then I'll come back to the British position, because while I think both of you have said that in terms of public perception, maybe the UK is not so unique when we compare it with other European countries, which is probably true, in policy terms, it is very different. And I want to highlight some of those differences. So let's put, I guess, national responses into context. Maybe let's start with the region of refugee, of the origin of a refugee crisis. So if you think about national responses to the Syrian crisis, we have countries in the region like Jordan, like Lebanon, like Turkey, right, who have taken in significantly higher numbers on their own than the EU has taken in as a whole. Right? So Lebanon, a country of 4.5 million people, at the moment hosts 1.1 million Syrian refugees. Right? Turkey hosts 2 million. Jordan, 600,000. Across the EU member states, we're talking at the moment 600, maybe 700,000 asylum seekers across the entire EU. And clearly, of course, between member states, responses have differed. Right? We've seen more restrictive responses in Eastern Europe, mainly some more open responses in Germany. When we talk about absolute numbers, but of course, we shouldn't forget that relative to their size, some smaller EU member states have always contributed a lot more in terms of refugee protection. If you think of countries like Sweden, Austria, Hungary recently as well, but then also countries like Greece, if there are 650,000 asylum seekers that have recently arrived in the European Union, 500,000 of those have come through Greece. Let's just think of the responsibilities and the burdens that the Greek government is facing at this moment. Not that they haven't got any other problems, of course. And so I think it's against this background that I think we need to talk about the role of the EU, what the member states can do in terms of coordinating their responses, because at the moment, clearly, the unequal distribution of responsibilities is as such that it really undermines any effective response to the refugee crisis. So what has the role of the EU been? Well, I'll just focus on three things here. The Dublin regulation that some of you might know, which allocates refugees to or asylum seekers to particular member states. It does so on the basis of the so-called first country of entry principle. So wherever an asylum seeker arrives in Europe, where they first arrive, that country becomes responsible and remains responsible for that individual, even if they move on to other member states. Which, of course, from a responsibility-sharing perspective, is just counterproductive. And we are only very slowly seeing a recognition among policymakers of that. Secondly, what the EU has tried to do, maybe less counterproductively, is to help to compensate some of the member states particularly affected by refugee inflows through financial measures. We have a European Refugee Fund, we have financial instruments to help with border control and border management and so on. And member states are quite keen. When we did research for the European Parliament recently, basically all member states that we talked to basically saw financial measures and financial compensation as the way forward. And I very much doubt that that is the solution to the issue. Not only is it because of the concerns that member states have about large inflows is not predominantly financial. Obviously, it is also financial, but it's not just financial. And when you see what kind of resources Europe makes available to individual member states, it is a fraction of what member states spend individually through their national budget. When we did the research for the European Parliament, we compared British receipts from the European Refugee Fund with what the government spent per asylum seeker per year. Britain got about 150 to 200 euros per asylum seeker from the European Refugee Fund. Home Office estimated that they spent between 25 to 35,000 euros per asylum seeker per year in the UK. So it's a symbolic gesture. And you might be able to increase financial resources, but never to the degree that it would effectively compensate, or let alone provide an incentive for some member states to do more, because they would be expecting some financial resources. The most promising EU response in recent times, but also the most controversial one, is the concept of internal relocation. So if financial compensation is not going to be the solution, we need to think of other ways to share responsibilities more equally and help external border countries like Greece, like Malta, and others. And so what we've seen in recent months has been an agreement, controversially, also very controversially adopted by a majority vote in the Council that actually outvoted some of the Eastern European member states, to relocate significant numbers of asylum seekers from external border countries, in particular Greece and Italy, to other parts of the European Union. We've just started to implement that scheme. Unfortunately, we have very low numbers so far. I think about 200 have only been relocated so far. So, and Poland has already said now, in the aftermath of the Paris attacks, that they are now opting out, or want an opt-out of that particular measure. So, as it was already controversial, it's even more controversial clearly now after Paris. Finally, the position of the British government. Let me finish with a few observations on this. I already talked about the obfuscation of the various issues, free movement, economic migration, refugee politics. And that clearly has, as I said, done a disservice to the debate. What makes Britain quite special in this overall discussion is that Britain, as one of the few countries, has an opt-out of EU arrangement when it comes to immigration and asylum management. And what we've seen the UK do is selectively opt into EU measures into measures such as the counterproductive Dublin regulation, or when we were talking about the safeguarding of minimum standards and minimum rights at the EU level, then the government, when it came to minimum standards on detention or access to the labour market or appeal rights, that's when usually the government decided to opt out. And we've seen opt outs on instruments such as the relocation scheme even Ireland, which has a similar opt-out to the UK, actually decided to opt into because they felt that they couldn't just stand on the sidelines. So instead, what we have, and you already mentioned this, is a government offer to resettle 20,000 Syrian refugees from neighboring countries of Syria over the next 5 years. So this is 20,000 over 5 years, right? Just remind you of some of the figures that I talked about earlier. I think 20,000 was the number that the city of Munich received in one weekend when the inflows were particularly high. What that shows, I think, in many ways, is that, in my view, the UK government's position shows a lack of solidarity with countries in the region, with other member states of the EU, and perhaps most importantly, with refugees themselves. I think it makes a mockery of the government's claim that it is leading on the refugee issue. It is likely also to have undermined a significant amount of goodwill that any continental European member state might have still have had in engaging with Cameron about the imminent renegotiation about the UK's relationship with the EU.
The microphone. Okay, thanks. Okay, very much. I mean, I suppose just as I've done with Sarah and Deborah, the reason the UK government would say that it had taken the positions that you've described is that, I mean, you know, in a sort of political naked self-interest sense, it wants to remain popular itself. But I mean, by both the previous presentations, really, that they presumably want to, and all European governments must be thinking about this now, ward off the risk that they'll, for solidarity purposes, deliver results within their boundaries that would kindle political forces they are trying not to kindle, if you see what I mean. So they're struggling with these two entirely opposing ideas, one of which is solidarity, and you've heard a lot about solidarity, understandably, recently. But on the other hand, not wanting to unleash political forces, some of which are beginning to get unleashed, have done for some years now, which they feel they can't control. Is that right? Is that fair? I mean, is that a reasonable riposte to what you said?
I think that is a very friendly kind of take on the government's position. Remember, this is the government that, when we were at the height of Mediterranean migrant deaths, was suggesting that rescuing migrant in the Mediterranean would present a pull factor and would encourage more migrants to come. So, obviously, there might always be people who think this, but for a government to come out and government ministers to come out with that kind of statement, lets me conclude on a slightly less friendly
attitude.
Sorry.
Just one note on that. Of course, politicians across Europe are sort of scared of these political forces being unleashed that you talk about. Well, one thing that's interesting in Britain is because of the electoral system, the mainstream British party, the Conservatives and the Labour Party, is far less threatened by parties on the fringes than in the rest of Europe. I mean, because governments across Europe, including in Germany, of course, they took a lot of migrants. So if the concern here is to think, oh, you know, what's going to happen with UKIP? You know, UKIP can get 14% of the vote and get one MP. So, I mean, in that sense, I mean, you might say they're representing public opinion, but in the sense of sort of being afraid, looking to over their shoulder to the right, they are far less threatened than all other governments in Europe with proportional representation.
True. No.
Okay.
I disagree.
So just one final thought from the chair before I throw this open. I'm intrigued myself by the fact that the control of the borders, whether it's through immigration or asylum, is always something that national governments do. And yet the problems, the issues, the challenges, public services and whatever, always end up locally. Okay? And what intrigues me about the UK governments, we haven't heard much about this publicly, it's quite hard to find this out, actually, I did a bit of research on this. The way asylum seekers arrive in the UK, and as I understand it, are distributed around the country, is to the places which have effectively the lowest property costs. Okay? So there's an effort not to have them in London and the South East, and there aren't that many in the South East outside London. Lots, a few in London because people have families and choose to, and there are rules about that. But most of them end up in poorer metropolitan districts in the North West and Yorkshire. Yes, and I just think that just something to think about is because if you take redistributing asylum seekers to the cheapest place to house them, you will accidentally move them to places where already the political forces that we're discussing are more likely to be easily induced. That's all I'd say. Just as a sort of, it's an internal British issue. I don't know how it's done in other countries. It's not much discussed in Britain, actually. But it's, I can see why it's not much discussed. Anyway, enough from me, from the chair. Right. Now, I'm sure we'll get lots of questions and thoughts. I'll take three at a time. Gentleman here, woman at the back, chap there. Okay, yes.
Thank you. It was a lovely presentation. My name is Paul McGraw. I work with the Catholic Workers Group, and we have 20 political asylum seekers that we house and accommodate. A question for Mrs. Macpherson. Could you explain how, on what possible basis, David Cameron made a campaign pledge to keep UK immigration under 100,000 when, in fact, any EU national has the right to come here and work. The UK universities are quite insistent that they need overseas EU and non-EU students who get included in that cohort of immigration. And the fact that any politician should have seen the likely increase in asylum seekers. So I don't see how they could possibly have made that campaign pledge. And on secondly, if I could make a short comment on comparing us, I deal with this every day of the week, the way that the UK deals with asylum seekers once they've given leave to remain compared with how they're dealt with in other EU countries.
Okay, and there was a woman at the back.
Hello, thank you so much. So I have, I guess, two questions. One, I think Mr. Thielman mentioned that political salience perhaps reduces EU harmonization in a way, if countries react to this as to increasing their borders, perhaps, if that's the political impetus at the time. So do you think that the high fear of immigration and asylum is perhaps a threat to European integration? And would one solution be to solve that the problem of the thought of the populace? And the second question is, I guess, with the advent of globalization and the human rights, for example, the Geneva Convention, kind of reducing the ability of countries to make their own decisions with regards to asylum seeking. So do you think the EU is perhaps an attempt to inadvertently increase the country's ability to make decisions with regards to asylum seekers and immigration as well? Thank you.
So just to check, I understood the final point was, do you think that countries will try to get opt-outs, as it were, or try to derogations from these international commitments?
Well, it's kind of an interesting loop, I guess, because the EU was an attempt to increase the ability of countries to make their own decisions with regard to asylum seeking, but at the same time, it's causing countries to re-exert their borders, which is doing, I guess, the opposite. So yeah, just your thoughts on that.
Okay,
thank you.
Very good. And there's a gentleman there, yeah.
David Ortan, a student here. So what you mentioned, the weak response of Ed Miliband to the problem of immigration, but what would be a good response from the left, from the Labour Party, but also from the European left more generally, to the problem of immigration, given that they have to accommodate two quite different views? One is the idea of the successful welfare state, you know, quite homogeneous and so on, if we look at the 70s and 60s in Scandinavia and so on. And one and the other is multiculturalism and diversity. So what would be a good response from the left? Thank you.
Okay, great questions. Now, Deborah, at least one of them was explicitly two, probably pointed at you.
I don't know why, because, I mean, you know, how can I possibly tell you why David Cameron would about anything? But
if you handle Gordon Brown, they're assuming you could handle David Cameron.
Simply the last person to ask on that. But actually, though, as a separate point, I mean, clearly he made the pledge in order to counter what, you know, the UKIP threat and so on. And that's also why he's, you know, attempting his renegotiation. Actually, one thing that you mentioned, though, that I wanted to pick up on, because this is something that I've done some work on, is the UK universities point, because I've actually done some work for the UK universities. There is a massive opportunity that isn't being taken at the moment, I think, by UK universities to tell people what a massive industry they are and what a contribution they make to the UK economy. Because people don't know that, and I know that when you tell people that, they are amazed and impressed and proud. And, you know, there is, and obviously, if UK universities don't have foreign students over and don't, you know, then that is going to be a problem, and any sensible government should be addressing that and doing everything they can to be as welcoming as possible to international students, in my view. And I think there's a positive case that can be made. Yeah, David's question up there is obviously the $64,000 question, really, isn't it? And it's, what is a good response? I don't know, because, you know, fundamentally, the problem is that we feel very disinclined to share our stuff with people that we don't feel very close to. And that's, I mean, that, you know, that's fundamentally the problem. And as I've said, you know, we also, for most people, the benefits of diversity and multiculturalism and so on are massively outweighed by what they perceive to be the negatives. And as I've said, you know, throwing stats at people doesn't really work. I think there are better ways to put the messages over, but I think, you know, the start point has to be for politicians to decide what they want. I mean, the one thing I would say is that I think that most people do see this area, as I've said, as a kind of very transactional thing. And maybe, you know, we know that the different sort of titles are not well understood, you know, whether somebody's an asylum seeker or a refugee or whatever. Actually, how most people would view it more sensibly is, you know, do we gain anything from this person being here first, or should we, you know, is there something we ought to give them, which would be in the case of refugees? And, you know, people are actually quite proud of Britain, what they see as Britain's tradition. You would disagree, obviously, but Britain's tradition in kind of welcoming people historically. And I think there's something to work on there.
I mean, isn't the underlying problem for the left, I mean, not to be huge stereotypes, that the left, by and large, believes in a bigger state and welfare at a scale, and that is really problematic with open or anything like open borders. I mean, if there were no welfare state and no welfare gaming, I don't mean gaming negatively, but you could move from state to state, it'd be far easier to have open borders than if people could immediately arrive and, for good reasons, immediately qualify for all the benefits of a carefully developed state. So in some ways it's more of a problem for the left than the right, as it is now appearing.
But I think it's a problem for the right as well. I mean, you know, in the end, I think UKIP, in the last election, probably caused as much harm to Labour as it did. Of course, you're quite right, Sarah, that, you know, compared with other European countries, because of the electoral system we have here, not so much to either of the main parties. But in the end, this is a big problem for Cameron as well.
Sure.
I'm really sure about that.
Just on that last point, I mean, I think generally if we look across Europe, it is a greater problem to the left, not only for the reason that you mentioned, but also because of the nature of their electorate. They have this sort of composite electorate of sort of these professional, cosmopolitan elites, often highly educated public sector, who are quite pro-immigration, actually. And then they have the sort of more working class, low skill, and they have, whereas on economic attitudes, on redistribution, they're quite united. They want, you know, a bigger state, more state intervention, and so on. But on issues to do with immigration, they're really polar opposites, and that's a bit less so for the right. So that's, you know, they have a split electorate, so therefore, in a sense, they don't benefit from immigration being salient because they can't really win. Again, the Labour Party is in a bit of a different position because they're not really threatened from the left, especially not with the current sort of state of the Liberal Democrats. So, you know, strategically, what do? You move to the centre, in other words, you move to the right on immigration. You don't do what Corbyn is doing, I think, in terms of, I don't think that's a winning electoral strategy if all you want to do is win. But it is a problem for the left across Europe, this issue of the rising immigration, because they can't please all their kind of natural constituents on that. And they can't outdo the sort of far right either on being sort of more anti-immigration than them. It's a losing strategy.
Yeah. I mean, basically, the task, I think, in the last Labour government, but of course this was an issue as well, was to neutralise it. I mean, it was always identified as an issue that Labour would be very unlikely to ever be able to win on, for the reasons you say and more, but, you know, just to kind of neutralise it as an issue.
Mm. Okay, what about this issue about the viability, really, of these sort of international, multinational agreements and arrangements, some of which you've referred to within the EU, but some of which are outside the EU. I mean, human rights legislation is not an EU issue, it's a, you know, Council of Europe issue. And I mean, borders, you know, the question about the future of borders, which have been provoked before the last few days, actually. All of the arguments are now running against the integrationist tide over things like borders, monetary union, well, in some cases, and possibly rights questions. Is that a bleak set of observations that you recognise?
No, I think you're probably right that certainly the events of the weekend will put more pressure on this wider debate. But I think we have to ask ourselves as Europeans. Do we want to stick up to certain values, for example, right? When it comes to refugee protection, of course, we've, as a group of European countries, but also, I guess, there are about 150 signatories to the Geneva Convention on Refugees, states have made a commitment that basic human rights should be protected, that they should have an obligation to displaced persons. And I think while we are, I guess, more readily willing to say, oh, we shouldn't let the terrorists kind of undermine our way of life, otherwise they would have won, there seem to be more people prepared to say, oh, well, we should now close our borders because there seems to be an increased security risk. And obviously, people jump to these conclusions very, very quickly. Of course, we know that probably the majority of the attackers were born in France and were raised there, did not come from outside the EU. But I have no illusions that whether or not that is true, the debate for a European dimension and free movement in Europe will only become more difficult. Although on free movement, I wanted to say one thing in response to your question, also the question about
and the left and the welfare state. All research that we know about on free movement, on intra-EU migration, and the impact of that migration on the British economy and the British public purse is that migrants from Eastern Europe have not disproportionately accessed the welfare state, quite on the contrary. The Home Office's own studies have shown that they've made a significant positive contribution to the public purse. So the idea that open borders, as we practice them at the moment, obviously they're not completely open borders, as you know, pose a fundamental threat to the welfare state is clearly untrue.
But I'm guessing Deborah would say that even though I agree that what you've described is broadly, is you know, what we heard actually at the previous seminar, but people believe something very different, don't they? Whatever they hear, they... I don't know, I mustn't...
It's media, though. It's media-driven.
All right, go on, say this. Go on. Yeah, no, go on, say it. It's the media.
Press, all the other presses. In terms of, like, UKIP vote, it's actually strongest in predominantly white areas, basically. So, something like 75% of areas that are white, you get, like, 2%, like, ethnic minority. And then you might get a 75% opposition to immigrants. So I don't know how that small amount of immigrants actually affect that white population. If it's not coming from media distortion, that's how I feel about it.
Okay, that was a good point. And Susan, I want to come back, because I think, though, that I heard earlier that the research probably suggests... that. Well, I'll leave it to our colleagues here. Susan, and then there's a gentleman there. So, Susan, yeah.
Susan Schofield speaking here as a primary school governor from North Kent, Gravesham, re-elected a Conservative MP. We have the largest Sikh population outside Southall, and the kind of challenge that we are facing at the moment is migration not only out of London to a cheaper area, but also from across the Channel, such that at our primary school, in special measures, we have just received at the start of term 20 new kids, completely unexpected, a third of whom do not speak English. And there is now what used to be a sort of retreat for away days, a reception centre, which is completely occupied by traumatised children travelling alone. Now, that is an anecdote, but this is the impact, and it is in the southeast, and it is real, and no one talks about it. But I repeat, this constituency has re-elected a Conservative MP.
Very interesting. Okay, and chap at the back, and then Martin. Yeah, and then we'll pause for some more responses.
Sarah mentioned the elephant in the room earlier, and I was wondering what the panel thought of the idea that perhaps the real elephant in the room for people is actually sort of their declining economic and political power, and in a neoliberal economy, which is undermining public services, and that when they go to their NHS and they're actually not getting the service that they expect, and they blame it on immigrants.
Okay, and then Martin.
Thanks.
And then I'll take you next, I promise.
In terms of the sort of impact on the welfare state, this is something I know quite well. I mean, in Sweden, it's not quite the sort of land of milk and honey of myth and legend, and you have a sort of insider-outsider phenomenon to some extent, focused on the various different sort of groups. So it's about the sort of the impact of that sort of, further down the line. But also I think, certainly in Britain, there's a perception about fairness, that people get something for nothing, and that's... Maybe you've tackled that with this sort of transactional thing that... and. With the economic insecurity, people who tend to think that they won't get a council house because an immigrant will get it. And that's sort of the issue, is it, or these issues, do they not underpin the sort of attitudes towards immigration and the sort of wariness of higher levels.
Okay, Andrew, I'll take a fist, because yes, in the very middle, and then we'll pause for question, for response.
Hello, I'm a student of International Migration and Public Policy, your course, and well, I have two questions in kind of different perspective, and I don't know too much about British politics, but I think the public opinion sends kind of like two contradicting signals to David Cameron, saying we should reduce asylum seekers and immigrants in general, and also saying David Cameron should have more leadership in Brussels. Well, in short term, like, referendum can be sword and shield, but I really don't know how David Cameron can handle in both contradicting public opinions. Well, not that I have like great sympathy to him, but I'm just curious about this. And the second question is that about relocation and the further step from relocation to maybe quota system. But is it ever going to work? I mean, because although like you miraculously adopted quota system, and like the refugees or asylum seekers, they have preferred countries in the European Union, and you can't really ground them to one town. So how is it going to work? Yeah, that was the question.
That's true. It's true. If you have the idea of somehow spreading people out, do you carry that principle on into countries as well? I mean, it's an interesting further thought. Right. Lots of points there. I'll do it in the reverse, not reverse order. Sarah first, Aiko, Deborah.
I mean, I think we know that the media matters and party framing matters, but I think it's a bit too easy to say, oh, this is this media distortion. I mean, I think Susan Schofield made a very valid point that migration is an issue for some people, and it is also the burdens and the problems that come with migration are not equally distributed across, you know, across regions, across individuals. So while some of it obviously has to do with the perceptions that people are given by political parties, by the media and so on, I think it's also easy to sit, you know, as I do in London as an EU migrant, and my son is obviously, you know, a son of migrants, go to school where there's 80% immigrants, but that's not a problem in Wimbledon. He's doing perfectly fine, yes? But it is a problem in other places. I mean, and I think saying that, therefore, oh, it's just the Murdoch press, and that's why people were concerned, and if they really knew, they wouldn't be, I think it's frankly, you know, a little bit arrogant. So there isn't a clear relationship between their interaction with our migrants and living close to migrants and whether your attitudes towards it. A lot has to do with your own, for example, socioeconomic status. Is it threatening to you? You know, am I going to lose my job because there are more Syrian migrants? No, the LSE is probably still going to have me as a professor. But if I was in a, I mean, you don't know, the EU referendum might indeed pack me back to Denmark, but even then I'll probably be okay. So I think these things are highly contextualized in terms of your own situation, but also, you're entirely right, and also the point, also how this is framed by politicians and so on. And of course we have a lot of political parties that like to blame particular groups. So it's easy for politicians to say, oh, you know, NHS is not working because all migrants go to the A&E rather than going to the GP, or we couldn't meet our targets because it's all about the EU. You know, politicians like blame avoidance and shifting blame. And in amongst politicians in Britain at the moment, we have sort of two favorite groups that we've talked about today. Migrants is one, and the EU is another. And it's both are convenient.
Okay, very good.
Yeah. Coming just briefly back to the role of the media, we started obviously asking, so why do people have these distorted views about, I don't know, the impact on the welfare state for free movement and so on. And of course it doesn't help if David Cameron on Thursday, when he published his letter to the European Council president, claimed that 40% of all EU migrants who had come to this country were receiving benefits of some sort, right? Obviously, he has got into a lot of trouble since then with his own statistical office, who basically didn't believe those figures. But I think
I think it is not just the media. Obviously, I think government has fed us a story about the negative impact of Eastern European migration for a very long time. And very little of that has been backed up by hard evidence, by the studies that have been conducted. The other question that I wanted to address is the question of relocation and how this is going to work. And of course, I think the first response would be, well, we do have national systems in place. We have a UK system, which is based on this dispersal idea, which seems to be not working particularly well. But you have lots of federal systems. You have Switzerland, you have Germany, that operate transfer system, where people, similarly to the EU scheme, get distributed on the basis of population size and GDP capacity across the various states of the federal territory. And I think the difference to the British system seems to be that you basically got support services established in all these different regions, which does not necessarily seem to be the case in the dispersal scheme here, where my impression is that some of these communities that receive migrants are ill prepared to deal with them. Clearly, and I mentioned this in my initial remarks, relocation will always be a challenge at the EU level. It's not clear what you do in a situation where individual member states might have very strong preferences to be in one country and not in another, even if that one country is heavily overburdened with numbers already. But I've strongly argued and made myself unpopular in the process that a voluntary relocation scheme, as many member states have suggested over the years, is just not going to work. If you ask people nicely whether they would like to relocate and have transferred over some people from your own territory, they're going to politely decline, and they have done so in the past. So, yes, compulsory relocation is highly controversial, needs to be cushioned up with accompanying measures that make this workable, but I really can't see a lot of alternatives.
Can I just press you? Because, I mean, I get your point about the dispersal system being fair, but I suppose if you were sitting in a country where public opinion was driving you to have fewer asylum seekers or fewer immigrants, you'd feel you hadn't got a control on the demand side. How would the decision be made Europe-wide about a total in the first place? Because at the moment, there are countries who are having to deal with significant numbers of asylum seekers and other, in particular, asylum seekers, but they didn't make the decision about them coming, as it were. I mean, partly because the first point of entry system. So if you're sitting, you know, in Hungary, how do they deal with Mrs. Merkel's decision-making? I mean, it's quite hard, isn't it? Because the decision-making's in one place, and the dispersal then is made by somebody else, and you're on the edge. So how's that going to be handled?
But of course, that's always been the situation that we've been under. We've signed international agreements which said that we are under a legal obligation to deal with people who have a well-founded fear of persecution in their home country. And if they reach our territory, then we are legally responsible to check whether they deserve protection or not. And only if we've reassured ourselves that they do not, then we are allowed to send them back under international law. So in a way, nothing has changed except that the numbers have become bigger, right? And obviously the numbers haven't become bigger because Europe has become so much friendlier. It's because we have significant crisis around the world that people are fleeing.
Some countries are friendlier than others, aren't they? Some countries have a different view about this than others, and that you'd have to have an agreed policy about the numbers coming in, wouldn't you, before you could have an agreed policy about their dispersal. That means two levels of decision-making which Europe can't make instead of one.
But in a way, what you're saying assumes that we can basically follow the UK government's approach and set a quota, which we can't. So if you want to regulate overall numbers, that's the only way to do it.
Sure.
So in a way, what the relocation scheme does is to say, all right, we've signed up an open-ended commitment, right? And we might regret it now, but that's what we did in 1951. And it is better for us all, collectively, in coordination, to deal with that open-ended commitment than to expect any individual country to do it on its own.
Okay, great. Thanks. Deborah.
Yeah, I mean, I was just thinking, you know, if some of the voters I've been listening to, actually about the EU, because I've been doing a lot of work on that lately, were listening to this conversation, it would be kind of shoring up their anxieties about the EU, because it's precisely those things that they have a problem with. And it's interesting, because you said at the beginning of your answer, you said, as Europeans, we have to think what our shared values are. Well, actually, by the way, I do think of myself as a European personally. I would just like to say that. Most people most people in Britain would never, ever use the expression as Europeans. They just don't think of themselves. I'm sorry. I mean, we might wish they did. I wish they did, but they don't. They just don't. And the idea of having shared values, I think they would say, this whole debate shows that we don't have shared values. Mm. I think this is one of the problems that we have to kind of, you know, we can't shy away from. And one of the things that, when I was doing the work for British Future on immigration, one of the things I did in focus groups was a sort of extended writing exercise where I'd ask people to just write down everything that came into their heads when they thought about immigration. And then when they thought they'd written everything, I'd say, no, you must write some more. I can't think of anything more. No, you've got to write more. Because, you know, you just get some really interesting stuff out. We then did a kind of analysis of vocabulary that was used across lots and lots of focus groups. And the expression that was used most often was small island, because somewhere quite early on people would say, the thing is, we're a small island. And they would, you know, they would find, and that would be their rationale. And, you know, this is how it is. We may not like it, but that's where arguments, I think, have to start. Before, if you want to try and persuade people, it is the only way you'll persuade them. I agree with everything Sarah said about the media point. I mean, I think even if that is where people get their views from, well, fine, they've got their views, so that's what we've got to live with. But actually, I also agree with your challenge to that too, and I think that the lady in the front row made the point very neatly when she talked about her own experience. I think that it's very dismissive, actually, of people's genuinely held views. For a lot of people, their views about immigration are born out of their reality. It is their reality. It is the reality of the parents in that school that this is going to give them a problem. It's a reality. And, you know, actually, it Cara's hands going, everybody hates me now.
No, that's all right.
You know, actually, it's about how vulnerable people feel themselves. So, you know, I live in North London. All my middle-class friends bloody love immigration. And it's great because actually, you know, these are the people that serve them their coffees, and it's fantastic. But actually, for a lot of people, perhaps in Gravesend, I don't know, there is a real threat, or they feel there is, and it's not something they've just got from.
And just take the small island point, nothing to do with immigration, but it is intriguing. You will often hear the expression about how the southeast is being concreted over. Okay, nothing to do with immigration, just to do with, you know,
yes.
Truth is, the southeast has a lower population density than the northwest of England, which includes the Lake District. But perceptions are extraordinarily hard to shift in these things. That's nothing to do with immigration. Right, you obviously wanted to come back.
Yeah.
Go on, and then here, and then here. Okay.
I just think that it's naive to underestimate the power of the media.
I don't think the speakers were underestimating the power of the media. They were saying
very powerful.
Perception is reality, I think, is sort of what was being said.
The media does distort, and there's been so many surveys and polls about it. For example, there's been a TUC poll, not related to immigration. On average, how many people thought that the welfare budget goes on, how much percentage of the welfare budget goes to unemployed people?
they think that 41% of the welfare budget goes to unemployed people. In actual fact, the figure is 3%.
Sure.
Right? There's loads of kind of public distortions fed by created by the media. I don't think it's been dismissive. I think it's been very naive to think that the media does not have a very powerful influence.
Okay, fair point and well made. Okay, and others agree with you as well. Gentleman in the middle here, and then right, and then here, and then there. Okay, but you. All right, we'll give you the microphone.
Go and shout.
But make sure the people at the back can hear you as well.
I'm getting in touch with my inner Marxist here, because I think Britain, in a certain sense, doesn't have an immigration problem. It has a problem with poor people on the move, some of whom have been made destitute by our actions. That's one point. The other point is, Deborah, I sincerely hope you're wrong, but if the UK does...
I hope I'm wrong as well, by the way, just
for the avoidance of doubt, as they say.
If Scotland does a UK and leaves the UK, as it were, then what?
Okay, then what? Okay, gentlemen here.
Yeah.
I have a question about... my name is Michael Curling. I've got a question about sort of British attitudes or how you see them developing. Deborah has talked a bit about the different focus groups and the different views in them and in the general public and the citizens, the view, the transactional view of the situation, and pointed out that if we want to talk to these people, if politicians want to talk to these people, that you have to pick them up where they are. And Aiko pointed out the different groups in immigration. And the fact is, the asylum seekers and refugees, the principle was once founded on a humanitarian principle, on altruism. It had nothing to do with this what's in it for me thing. There was once a shared principle in Western culture that there is a human right for a refugee status. It was based on a shared value system that seems to have disappeared completely out of the discourse here in the UK. And it seems from what you said about the focus groups that there is no willingness to make that a part of the argument. And in fact, if one wanted to be cynical, one could say that those people who complain most about the Muslimization, and say that we're a Christian country, it's the Christian values that once established this in our Western value system, and in fact in law. So the question is, do we have to accept that that is not a shared value anymore that exists in British culture?
All right.
I just have one final.
All right, go on, yes.
Supplementary to that, we're about the something for nothing society. It's the people who belong to the same something for nothing society that Cameron belongs to that are very welcome to come here.
Right, and there's a gentleman here.
Basically, it was about the small islands mentality, really, and about how you earlier on had mentioned about Britain in the past had welcomed people from various parts of the world to persecution, economic refugees. So in the same breath, or say two different breaths, you could actually extend it and say we're not a small island. We could try and think about the world that we live in and affects the crises which are going to, from climate change and the numbers of 60 to 70 million people a day who are moving into adjoining parts of the world to try and get away from the effects of this chaotic and crisis-ridden global system, which is about 300 or 400 years old, creating wars, degrading lands, creating drought with the global warming. So we've got to expect workers. You're not going to stay in a place. There's a push movement. You have to move out because you can't survive. Where are they going to go? The thing is, we've got to address the causes, which are economic and social, trying to deal with the effects when people are moving because there's a war in Syria. Previously, there was a war in Iraq. Iraqis went to Syria. Now there's a war in Syria because they think they might want to get access to Iran, all to do with the carbon economy of this type of system. So my point is, why don't we think of it in global terms and think about what we can do to try and stave off and help...
Wouldn't David Cameron, though, say... I mean, one of David Cameron's rejoinders has been the UK is now spending more on overseas aid than pretty well any country as a share of GDP, and it hasn't really galvanised all the other countries, as we were told it might be, to lift their share. So What would you suggest? I mean, again, you know, what would people suggest as a way? Well, it's too late, really. But what would you suggest you could get the world to do to raise its share of GDP devoted to overseas aid to help the conditions, the issues that you've described, be handled nearer home? Because that's what Cameron says he's doing. In fairness to him,
the problem is about GDP, because all the world thinks about, and all nation states on the planet is thinking about growth, economic growth, and not about the social and environmental effects that growth leaves in its wake, and the problems it leaves in its wake, that then the governments who actually are engaged in growth then have to somehow try and deal with.
Okay, right. Now we have one final roundup of responses, because when we must finish, it's 8 o'clock.
Okay.
Solidarity in particular, where did that go?
Yes, two quick points. I take Deborah's point about that the British would not start from the presumption that we share certain European values. But of course, the legal obligations that were referred to with regard to refugee protection are not European obligations, they're national obligations. It's something that previous governments signed up to. So it's not something that is imposed by the onto the British by the Europeans. Second point, very quickly, on the question of island mentality, I mentioned the case of Lebanon at the beginning. So a country where 20% of the resident population are now refugees from Syria. So the equivalent in the UK would be, 15, 17 million people from Syria in the UK. So, and of course, in my view, it's the easy choice to say, we're giving more money than anybody else. Well, if you asked other countries whether they would rather give more money or accept refugees, they would all say, I give more money, right? But that's not the solidaristic thing to do in the face of a crisis. And I don't think, therefore, that the argument that we're giving more aid than everybody else really washes in this context.
Fair enough.
Just to say that I don't think I was saying that the media doesn't matter. I entirely agree with you. The media can shape opinions and distortions and does so in this case. Just to say that we do have immigration concerns that are also founded in other things than what people read in the media. And also in countries where you have a much more pro-immigration media, you have immigration concerns. Just France as an example. Marine Le Pen is polling as number one to be the next French president, and the media is different in France. You can say then people's opinions are formed by political women, which is to say it's a bit more complex when we look at opinion formation. I'm not trying to be naive, but it's a bit more complex when we look at the research on it than simply saying, you know, if the Daily Mail, which obviously has an agenda to shape opinion on immigration, if the Daily Mail wasn't there, then the Brits would be very pro-immigration. And the small island thing, you know, it also exists in countries that are not islands. And even Sweden, where there's been a lot of opinion leadership, we've talked a lot about following opinion, but not a lot about what politicians can do to shape opinion. And of course they have a role, and the Swedish mainstream parties have really done that. They've said, we're not engaging with the populist right, we're not engaging with the Swedish Democrats, and they've taken a lot of refugees. And now they've had to close the borders, and they're, you know, in a sense, they're also at breaking point because there are real issues that are also not distributed equally, and not to say they won't continue to be a pro-immigration, pro-refugee countries, but they're also struggling with the real issues, and that we're not talking 15 millions, but we're talking hundreds of thousands that they're really struggling to cope with it. So it is a real issue, and that, I guess, what I was trying to say, not just one created by the media, even though they do their best.
Deborah.
Yeah, the refugee question. I mean, to the question, roughly how many Syrian refugees do you think the UK should take, right? As I think I've already said, I think one in five, in answer to that question, 19% of that say 20,000 or more. Of that, actually 2% say a million or more, and 1% say 500,000 or more, but 27% say none. None. So a quarter of British people.
Should we take a vote? Let's just see. I did this last time. Let's see. How many people think that David Cameron's 20,000 over 5 years commitment is enough? How many people think 100,000 would be about enough over 5 years?
Enough for what?
Well, enough to make you personally feel the right thing was being done. Is 100,000 about the right number? 500,000? Anybody think 500,000?
No.
So that's nearer. And more than 500,000 is enough? Okay. So I think we've established that...
Though a very typical audience. Yeah, that's
excellent, a wonderful audience. Different
to... You're not going to recruit us for your focus group.
Well, you have to include some of them, because they're part of the... Anyway, Deborah, I interrupted
you.
Yeah,
I mean, well, no, it's good to know.
One point we haven't touched on is will countries be allowed to cherry-pick who they take? I mean, the people cutting Cameron are saying we're taking from the caps. Yes, well, yeah. Of course... I mean, I think Merkel is quite wise because
exactly.
People are coming. Syrians are the best educated in the Middle East. Okay. Engineers.
The question is,
all I was going to say to your question, I think, was, you know, do we have to accept that kind of fundamental belief in a right to refugee status doesn't exist anymore in this country, and. I don't know if we have to accept this as the status quo forever, but I think it clearly is not something that everybody in this country thinks.
Okay, look, I think it's been, whether you agree or disagree with all the things you've heard, we've all been challenged this evening, which is really good. That's partly because of the excellent questions and the comments that have been made from the audience, but mostly because of our, well, also, of course, because of our excellent panellists. So... Deborah Mattison, Sara Hubbold, Aiko Tiernan. Thank you very much all for coming tonight, and I'm sure we will do other events on this subject. I suspect it's not going to go away. It's one where deconstructing even our own thoughts and feelings about these issues, I think, is still very important. So, Aiko, Sara, Deborah, thank you very much, and thank you all.